National School Public Relations Association, 34th Annual Seminar, Meeting the Challenge, July 13th through the 16th, 1987, San Antonio, Texas. This is tape number 54.
And an exciting teacher who naturally motivates others to want to emulate his style. Pat, who less than 2 hours ago received INSPRA's Learning and Liberty Award, is a winner on other fronts as well. From a 1978 poll of PR practitioners, he was named one of the 20 most respected public relations professionals and one of three in a 1982 poll. 3 years later, in 1985, he was the winner of the Arthur W. Page Award for, quote, Outstanding Public Relations Professional. He has been listed in Who's Who in America. In 1980, our presenter served as the national president of the Public Relations Society of America and has been PRSA's national secretary, member of the national chapter board of directors, and a member of the National Minority Affairs Committee. This accredited member of PRSA co-chairs a progressive PRSA task force on demonstrating professionalism, and I recently observed his leadership with this activity in a meeting in New Orleans, Louisiana. Pat is an editor and popular lecturer who's conducted workshops for CASE, PRSA, the Academy of Hospital Public Relations, the Canadian Public Relations Society, and of course, INSPRA. From a current charge, INSPRA's accreditation committee is seeking a reciprocity agreement with PRSA, whereby INSPRA-accredited members who are members of PRSA would be listed ASPR in PRSA directory and vice versa. And Pat is pointing us, INSPRA, in the direction that we need to take to make this happen. We appreciate you for that. Ladies and gentlemen of INSPRA, let's welcome again the Senior Counsel for Jackson, Jackson and Wagner, an international public relations counseling firm, Mr. Patrick Jackson, as he unveils ways to sell your program to your administration and your board. Pat?
Thank you very much. What I should have said this morning was maybe more along these lines, and this is a way I'd like to tailor our time together here, if I may. I should have said that the social scientists and the sociologists have made it so clear that indeed public education is the essential underpinning of our kind of democratic society. And I believe that experience in school districts all across the United States and Canada, at least, is showing us that it is the public relations activities, the public relations philosophies, and hopefully the public relations professionals in those districts that are helping to make this essential link between public education and democracy. So this morning, when we're talking about selling our programs to our administration and to the publics that we have to serve, let's not just think of that in a kind of a labor union, self-serving way. I'm going to do better. I'm going to be higher on the charts. I'm going to be better rewarded in my paycheck. But let's remember that we bring something else to this process, that we're talking about being recognized better, not just for us, though that's important to motivate us, but for a very, very essential cause of the entire nation and probably the entire world. It should be clear from Bernice's very flattering introduction that I have been able to con some people. And so this morning, what I really want to share with you is conning 101, okay? Now, see, I don't mind that term. I don't mind being called a confidence man, because what does that mean? That means the ability to get people to have confidence in you. And that's really what we're talking about here today, is how can we get people to have confidence in us and what we do. If I'm a little clumsy up here today, it's because there's no lavalier mic, and they do want to record this session. So some of the things I do that look a little odd, it isn't just Jackson being odd as usual, it's because of that situation. I'm concerned about whether we as professionals in this field, or people who ought to be professionals, are really focusing on the right things. And most of you who've ever heard me know that I do have that concern. And now I see preliminary data from the survey of members. And what do I find the most important things that we list we do to be? The top three public relations activities are: one, preparing publications; two, media relations; and then three, counseling the administration and school board. If I were a superintendent, those first two items would bother me greatly, because after you've issued the publication, after you've placed the media, hopefully, I would still have a very big question. So what? What can you show me as a member of the board, or me as an administrator, that those activities have done in a way that I can measure to demonstrate that you are building relationships, building trust and confidence in the school system, or helping in the educational process? It seems to me that we will be professionals when number three becomes number one, because the problem isn't in putting out publications and in dealing with the news media. Frankly, most districts could and should forget the news media. They can make a lot of trouble, but have you ever known them to really do much for you? Not often. Oh, sure, they write a nice little thing here and there, but if you track that, it's hard to say what it did for you as well. And so, therefore, the problem, I am convinced, lies with administrators and with school boards. They need to understand the public relations philosophy. And isn't it interesting that people who are elected under the democratic system sometimes get onto the board and suddenly now they become dictatorial? All of the things they learned about getting onto that board go right out the window once they're there. Who is going to change this, if anybody? Who is going to deal with this and make education a really bottom-up, bubbling thing? We are, provided we can build that confidence. So let me share with you some of the things that I and a number of others have discovered over a period of time on how to build that confidence. I want to give you some very specific activities, some things that I hope you can take home and will take home and start next week. And let's start right at the top. Nothing will sell you and your activities to your school district like having a formal plan. How many people have a formal public relations plan? And how many people follow that plan? Please don't do the plan in a notebook. Don't do it in a file folder, because they go on the shelf and in the drawer. And you all know what happens to things when they're on the shelf and in the drawer. Nothing much. Do a plan. Post it where everybody can see it. Be held accountable for it. It's the simplest and oldest trick. Show what you've got. Show what you're going to do. Show what you've done. But anybody in our field today who believes that he or she can really function without a roadmap, without a plan done every year, at least, really is not being a professional by the definition of professionalism. And so, first of all, we've got to take the time and trouble to have a formal plan. Now, as we become adept at the planning process, then we can start doing some other things that really build confidence. For instance, we can get other administrators and other people in the system to help us each year with that plan, until pretty soon it isn't our plan, it's the district's plan, the organization's plan. Well, obviously, if we're all sitting together to plan this, it's a pretty short step for those folks who are with us, even with some doubts, to losing the doubts and seeing the essentiality of this exercise. It just never fails to flabbergast me that our studies at PR Reporter indicate something like 5% of public relations practitioners actually have and use formal plans. If you ever complain that they don't consider what you say, that you're not in a high enough position, and you don't have a plan, Really, you have no one but yourself to blame. How can the administration know what you're worth if you can't put it down and bet your job on it by saying at the start of the year, this is what I'm going to do, this is what it's going to do for the district, and this is how I'm going to do it, and what I'm going to have it done by, and what it's going to cost. You know, teachers aren't allowed in the classroom without lesson plans, right? What's your lesson plan? And as your super, may I please see a copy? Because we don't let teachers into the classroom without seeing their lesson plan. This is our lesson plan. I don't want to overemphasize the point. It's just that we've been talking about this for so long, and still most of us are too busy to take the week, the 3 days, whatever it takes, to do a plan. Please, do plans. If we don't do that, everything else I'm going to tell you really is superficial. Secondly, when we do the plan, let us never forget that what we're after is the district's goals, or the organization's goals, or even, in some instances, the superintendent's goals, the board's goals. Not what we want to do necessarily, but what they want done. So that the first step in any plan is to know what those goals are and to make sure our plan speaks strictly and specifically to those goals. Now, there's an interesting byplay here, fascinating byplay, because once we say to fellow administrators, we want to do our plan for the year, what are our goals? Aha, that's right. The snickers come because they say, well, gosh, gee whiz, I'm not sure. Here's a chance for leadership. Here's a chance for us to talk about goal-oriented management, which too many school districts either have lacked or have not communicated, because clearly publics do not understand what the goals of our districts are far too often. And so if in doing our plan, it leads us to being a catalyst for the district to clearly enunciate its plans, its mission, its values, its vision, if those things aren't already in place, we've now already scored in helping to get confidence from others. But above all, if our plans do not address the goals of the organization, then we are, aren't we, irrelevant, because that's all the organization cares about. Furthermore, of course, if we can get involved in that process, we may be able to get some goals that we see important added to the list of the district's goals. Some of you, I know, are very good at this. Other districts, frankly, just haven't stepped up to the plate on that one, and I don't see how we can avoid that. The third thing, it seems to me, is that it's terribly important to do what we say we will do. So if you haven't got a plan that's posted, that's clearly readable and distributable to all the key people that you want to know what you're committing yourself to, try a little technique that once won a famous American very large prize, a man named Charles, what was his name? It wasn't Schwab, he's the discount broker. Well, he was a famous steel executive, the first president of U.S. Steel. And when Andy Carnegie was forming U.S. Steel, he was concerned that he couldn't get everything done in his business day. So he offered a $25,000 prize, which in the late 1880s was like $1 million today. He offered a $25,000 prize to anyone who could give him a plan that would show him how to make his day better. And the person who won this prize was this steel executive whose name was Charles and starts with S and has a museum in New York, and I can't remember. And he, by the way, then became Carnegie's secretary and then became president of U.S. Steel and founded a great American dynasty and fortune in his own right. And what he told Carnegie was that you prioritize the things you're going to do, and then you list them. You list them right up there, and you stick it right up on a wall in front of you, and then you do them. And the reason it works, said Charlie, is not only that you can see it and it focuses your mind, but also everybody else can see it too. And he says somehow that has a marvelous effect on us. when we've said to others, I'm going to do it, and they can see that we made this promise, and they're constantly kind of looking over there and saying, you haven't done it yet. When are you going to do it? So try that technique. Make a list of what you said you're going to do. Everything from a simple letter to a major plan, anything you promise out there, and stick it up on a board somewhere, on a cork board, on a chart, so that people can come and check on you if they want to. And then when you've done it, fill it in. It's a simple little technique. A lot of these things are terribly, terribly simple, but they have just worked wonders for people who are using them. Another thing that I find is very essential is to know the body of knowledge and to show that you know it. And now, of course, we can get into a long argument here. What is the public relations body of knowledge? However, I'm pleased to announce that will soon be at least a more tangible argument. PRSA in this city in less than a month is convening a session of 15 leading educators and 6 practitioners known to be knowledgeable on this subject. They're going to lock us up in a room, and at the end of that time we are going to have agreed on at least the first 150 entries of research in the public relations body of knowledge. Those will then be fleshed out by graduate students. And by early next year, at least that first cut at the body of knowledge will be available for computer retrieval. Since ENSPRA has been the leader in the use of computer networking, I assume that once it is available, that it would be available to you through your educational computing system. But if you don't know the body of knowledge, you're at a terrible disadvantage. Because the only thing you can say when you're dealing with your colleagues is, I think. Well, I think we ought to do this. Or, well, it seems to me. Now, are you persuaded by that kind of argument? I'll tell you, superintendents that I know are not persuaded. But superintendents, other administrators, board members are persuaded when you can say, well, on this topic, we have 2 or 3 theoretical studies, some case studies, which really seem to speak to this. Let me share them with you. And you just kind of start putting them down. And a wondrous thing happens. Suddenly people start saying, I can't believe it. Our PR person knows something. It's an absolute eye-opener. And you know, another interesting thing starts happening. And this really, those of you who know me know, this is my basic stock in trade. When I step up to the board and I start writing these things down, I have found that the pencils come out. People start writing down what I have put up there. And I'm talking about hard-line school board members. Not all of them, of course, but enough of them that you are now doing the critical thing. You are, in fact, positioning yourself as someone who has a special expertise. You are dealing with that age-old problem that everybody understands public relations. Anybody can do this job. And suddenly you start talking about subjects that anybody never heard of. And so you have blanketed that criticism. You have put those who say, well, everybody knows about that, on the defensive. But you see, how else can you do that? You can't sit there knowing some things that they don't know and then just get into an argument with them, well, I know more than you do. And they say, oh, no, anybody can do this. That doesn't work. That's not negotiation. This is negotiation because you just raised the stakes. And the only way they can counter you is with some other research, some other theory that says otherwise. And frankly, if they do that, it's a wonderful opportunity because now you and maybe some assistant superintendent are engaged in a wonderful argument about the body of knowledge of public relations. My Lord, it's probably the first time that person ever considered it. And you have become an educator by leading them into the subject. Isn't that what good teachers do? We kind of lure them into studying mathematics by talking about 1 orange and 2 apples. And what they're interested in is the orange and the apple. But we lure them into studying mathematics. Here's a chance to lure them by positioning yourselves in two ways. One, as a knowledgeable person, but secondly, as a strategic executive, not as a service unit. Now, I won't embarrass you by asking how many of you see yourselves as service units, as communicators, as people who carry the message. But I do hope those of you who have this feeling will do two things. First, take a look at those attitudes, if you have them, and ask yourself whether people who get into responsible positions see themselves as just kind of carrying out some sort of a function like that. Or do people who get into the leadership roles have a far broader spectrum? I don't think you'll find many people who do the little nuts and bolts that get to the top, or indeed if they do get there, that succeed. So first we have to look at our own attitudes about ourselves as strategic executives. The second thing that I think we have to do after we look at ourselves is to really sincerely ask, are we willing to take the risk of being a strategic executive? Because you see, it's easy to be a communicator. Just tell me what messages you want to send, gang. You put a sign up on your desk that says Western Union. Just bring me those messages and I'll get them out there. But of course, you'll be like the janitor. When we want the room cleaned, we call. In the meantime, don't bug us. Go on listening to your baseball game or whatever you do back there in the furnace room. You see? Now, I'm being very serious when I talk about this. Because one of the things we need to do when we think about risk is to take a look at what's happening in organizations all over this continent as downsizing and bottom line and efficiency become the rules. Who is surviving in public relations position in organizations? It is not the specialists, the communicators. They are a dime a dozen, a drug on the market. Managers can hire this kind of expertise any place. It's all over. The people that are surviving are executives, strategic thinkers, generalists, people who understand the field, who can truly be called in by fellow senior managers and asked, what should we do about this? How do you see this situation? What's coming down the pike? Clearly, whether they like it or not, managers of all kinds of organizations have had to deal with the problem or the opportunity of positive relationships, of building latent readiness for the organization so that when triggering events occur, people will behave in ways that are useful. I think a lot of managers, frankly, would love to have fields like ours reduced to just communication, and if all the other managers would just do their thing, you know, then Napoleon walks again, and he can walk down the aisle and order us all around. It's kind of built into the psyche of a lot of managers, but they're practical folks, and they see that, those days are over. They were born 50 years too late to get away with that. And so who then do they want to surround themselves with? They want to surround themselves with people on their level, people who can contribute, who can really help them, not people that they have to tell what to do. Well, I don't want to overemphasize the point, and I know, whether you're admitting it or not, that it makes a lot of you damn uncomfortable. But I can only say to you, don't take my word for it. Just take a look at what's happening as organizations downsize. Yesterday, I was in Boston speaking to CASE, which, as you know, is our higher education counterpart. And I made a statement to them that our research indicates. And that is that I'm not sure this is true of the schools because we've been a little slow to get our programs up to the full staffing and full budgets and full activities that we ought to have, but universities have been there for a long time. And I made the statement to them based on our research that 50% of the things they do can be dropped without a ripple, without a ripple. And I know because we have been doing a lot of downsizing for clients. And I can only tell you, right in this city, I was at a ranch in this very city just a little over 2 years ago with the executive group of a major American corporation. and we were looking at how we could reduce their staff sizes in order to be competitive, because they do have a problem. If they don't reduce their costs, they're not going to survive. And we were able to cut the relationships units by 50% of personnel. Now, we only cut 10% out of the budget, but we were able to reduce the staff to half. And at first, I was very worried about this. I thought, oh, here we go again. Times are tough. We'll get rid of that one thing of all things that can help us compete. But the management assured me, Pat, that's not right. You've sold us. We believe in this. It's just that they asked the question, so what? And often there weren't answers. So out it went. A year later, when we did our annual evaluation for them, the efficiency and the effectiveness of that department had almost doubled. Half the people doing half the things were twice as effective. Don't take my word for it. Check it out. Are you going to be in the group that's strategic, that's managerial, and deals with philosophy and issues and overall public relationships and survive? It's your call. But I just want to make the point that I'm not fooling you. Of course, in order to do that, you got to be willing to take risks. And this is not easy. But there's an interesting thing about risks. If you get your act together, it's very safe to take risks. What you do first is you get the board and the management to agree to the modern organizational philosophy, which is that we want to support risk-taking. Okay, get them first to agree, by golly, we want to support risk-taking. Then you see, when you take a risk and it doesn't work out, you can say, well, I'm just doing what you told me. I took a risk, and this one didn't work. Now, we have a lot of good support here. A lot of departments exist on risk. The innovative teaching methods, which every district in America is starting to take a look at, isn't that total risk? We don't know if that stuff will work. And sometimes we have to fold it up and say, no, not that one. Let's try something else. If you're in a corporate life, R&D, engineering, all of those things, even this downsizing, financing is a risk. We don't know yet for sure. And yet that risk is encouraged. So first, let's encourage risk. And then secondly, let's be willing to take it. The interesting thing is, when you take a risk, and you clearly announce to everybody, never take a risk without saying, boy, I'm taking a big risk on this now. See? No, I'm serious. This is part of the technique. You say, all right, I'll take that risk. All right, you're calling my bluff. I'll take that risk. See? Because what you get from fellow managers, even the ones that show it the least, is respect. Because frankly, most of those administrators haven't taken a risk in 30 years. Does your administration, is it risk-oriented? Good for you if you've got one. Yeah, 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 exactly. And I wonder if there's a correlation between that and schools in trouble. All of the experts say that is the correlation. So here again, I think you can get respect for it. And look, don't be worried about it. We all make mistakes, and it is possible to take risks and fail, and indeed come out very much on top with your fellow managers, because they know you had the guts and that it was a good idea if you've been able to really sell them on it enough to let you take the risk. Everybody makes mistakes. Remember, a 400 hitter in baseball can strike out 6 times out of 10 and still make, what would a 400 hitter make today? $4 million a year? I don't know, some ludicrous sum, you see? So just say to your gang, hey, look, I'm only a 400 hitter. I'm only leading the league by 42 points this year. Because some of my things didn't work out, but the others did. And you know, always, you've heard me say this before, but always remember Moses. Moses, undoubtedly the most revered human that ever lived. The Christian, the Judaic, and the Muslim cultures all revere this man as their founder. No one can match that record, and yet he made a horrible mistake. Because when he was leaving Egypt, leading the children of Israel, he took a left turn, and he found the promised land. And remember, if he had turned right, he'd have had the oil. Okay. Some pretty practical stuff. What are the goals of your superintendent? Never mind up here now, we talked about the district goals and our plans are going to tie this. Now let's get down to very specific one-on-ones. Do you know what the goals of your superintendent are? They're really personal goals. And if you don't, find out. Take the super to lunch, I don't care. Have him over to the house, have breakfast. And get personal. And say, you know, I could really do a better job for you. Find out what you're, I mean, you know, share with me. I'm your counselor here, I won't tell anybody. I mean, are you running for governor? Do you want to get a bigger district? Do you just want to get old Molly off the board so she quits bugging you? You know, what is it? See? Because notice what you're doing. If you even attempt that, even if he says, go away, I only share that with my wife, you know, then ask his wife, of course. But that's... You're going to see that come up on the list. It's one of the great techniques. But the point is, even by suggesting that, do you see what you're doing? You're positioning yourself. I am your counselor. And if you'll just tell me what you want, and just between us, my lips are sealed. But tell me what you want, and you and I will make a pact right now as to how that also fits into what's going on here. Because we are kidding ourselves if we don't know that. I never have a client or a chief executive of a client organization, at least, that we don't sit down and say, okay, what's your game plan? Where do you want to be in 5 years? Where do you personally want to be in 5 years? And you know, there's reticence at first, but ultimately they share it with me. And boy, we refer back to that time and again. And we say, I'm not sure I'd do that because that's going to conflict with your five-year goal, your personal five-year goal. And sometimes we have to say, hey, This is a tough one for you, Joe, because it kind of conflicts with your five-year goal, but I think your responsibilities to the organization demand you do it now, don't you? But you see how what you're saying to them is, I care about you as a person. That's counseling. And if we want to position ourselves as strategic executives, then we will find out. Now, if we know these personal goals, and again, sure, it's risky, but it isn't really. Most of you have the kind of relationships, even with supers that you don't like and don't like you, where at least you can bring this up and kind of waltz around it and you'll get some intelligence from it. Otherwise, you call in the CIA and they find out, and I'll tell you how to do that in a minute. The thing I think you need to realize, particularly about school executives, is that maybe 1 in 100 is motivated by opportunity, by challenge, by the opportunity for success, and 99 are motivated by sheer, stark fear. I mean, look, I say this to AASA, I might as well say it to you. Now, how about those fears? What are those fears apt to be? Well, someone made a nice list. Think about this. Is it fear of failing? Is that why they won't do the things? Are they afraid they can't pull it off, or the organization can't pull it off? Is it fear of losing turf? You see, the assistant super doesn't want to do this because the other assistant super and this principal and that principal, is it turf? Is it fear of embarrassment? Oh my God, my picture will get in the paper. Of course, today it's usually the opposite, isn't it? My God, this might get my picture in the paper. Is it fear of losing control? Those are the four fears that we need to know are the motivators for our fellow executives and people on the school board. And if we know their personal goals, we can start dealing with their fears. And I'm telling you, you get so good at this, pretty soon you can play those people like the piano. And I'm not talking in a manipulative way. I'm talking about ending the hours of back and forth jousting that goes on. It's totally unproductive, but they're not going to level with you, and you're trying to get it out of them. See if you can get it up front, and then you can really deal with them. Some very simple suggestions to let you make this kind of entry. What does your boss read? What did that tough person on the school board read or listen to or watch? What are the known external influences? Find out. And this is where you ask the secretary, the spouse, the kids, and then you read it too. So if they read Change magazine every month, you read Change Magazine. And when something that comes along that's pertinent, either stop them in the hall or at a meeting and say, you know, I read a funny magazine called Change, and it had this interesting article last month. And suddenly they say, my God, a fellow true spirit. Or if they don't do that, even if they don't even blink, they got to be thinking inside, I can't, not only do they know something, they can read. You see, it starts to have a cumulative effect, but truly find it out. And there are other subtle ways of doing it. Just send them an article out of the magazine you know is important to them. I know it's so simple and corny, I can't tell you how it works. In fact, I have to leave here to go with a client this afternoon that for 4 years I have been trying to get to do a certain thing. Couldn't get it done. I found out that this particular, it's a president of a commercial organization, that this particular president is very proud of being young and a member of a group called the Young President's Organization. So we placed an article on what we wanted to do in the Young President's Organization by a third party. He read it, and I'm going there today. We're going to start doing it. He wouldn't listen to me, you see. It's just old Pat, you know, on his big fat retainer. What does he know? But he saw it in the Young President's Organization, and bingo, he's doing it. I just pray to God the client he's modeling it after doesn't tell him that they're also a client of ours. But they're risks. You got to take risks. So, read the same stuff. Read the same stuff. You know, this can even go to the point, there are still a few people around that read poetry or that have a famous novelist. You could quote that back to them. Just show them you're a kindred spirit. So I'll just put kindred spirit here. And by the way, if you think this doesn't work, if you think, oh, come on, Pat, you can do better than that. Have you ever been in a meeting with strangers and suddenly you find out somebody in the meeting is from your hometown or went to the college you did or knows your old boyfriend's third wife? I mean, have you ever been... Right away, don't you suddenly expand your confidence in that person? Well, it's just the same psychological principle, and it works. How about becoming yourself a trainer in the organization? You become an educator of educators. I don't care what you can give a course on. There's got to be something that you can teach in the in-service training program, or that you can offer free brown bag lunch courses on. Maybe it's more effective writing, or how to absolutely screw up desktop publishing, or something. I'm very good at that. Find a subject that has some relevance, better memos, shorter memos. How about that one? Teach a course in shorter memos. And frankly, it doesn't even matter if people come or if there is even a course. Just make sure there's lots of posters around saying you are going to teach it. The goal, you see, is to position yourself as someone who knows something and therefore is teaching a course. You'll get lots of jokes, lots of kidding on this. People will stop you in the hall and say, gee, I didn't know you knew anything about that. I read your last memo and it was 6 pages. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You have at least, in the first step of the diffusion process, you have created the awareness that maybe, just maybe, you have some special knowledge. And that's the whole goal here, isn't it? In getting confidence, is to show that we have some special knowledge. The third thing. And by the way, you don't have to do that in-house. Do it anywhere in the community. Do it in, speak at the ENSPRA meeting. Speak at PRSA or IABC or Women in Communication or I don't care. Speak to the Rotary, but on a subject of your expertise. That's what counts here. The next thing is a subject that I get a lot of arguments on, but I am just totally persuaded you're not going to convince me. My mind is made up. Use the jargon of the field. Do not speak simple English to fellow administrators. Well, first of all, it's only fair. Do they ever speak it to you? More importantly, the way in a highly technological society that people demonstrate that they have special, unique, different skills is to put labels on them that the average person cannot understand.
This completes side one. Please flip tape over and start at other side at this point.